Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh makes his monthly visit to take your calls. We'll cover the firefighter contract, casinos, last week's marathon, diversity, and Frosted Flakes. You can speak to him directly at 877-301-8970. Then Emily Rooney joins us for Open Mic. We'll focus on accused murderer Jared Remy's angry letter to Marjorie Egan at the Boston Herald. Followed, of course, by Emily's famous, some would say infamous, list.
Okay, you ready to eat sautéed scorpions or deep-fried caterpillars? How about if eating them could help save the Earth? Then our Friday news quiz with two voiceover wizards. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
By the way, very powerful piece in the Herald this morning, which we will discuss at 1 o'clock with Emily Rooney. But first, here with us in Studio 3, as he is the last Friday of every month, is the mayor of Boston. That would be Marty Walsh. He'll be taking our questions and yours at 877-301-8970. We're also live streaming at WGBHnews.org, so you can see what he looks like. And you can send an email to BPR. Well, I mean, that's why it's there. And to BPR@WGBH.org, and today he looks mighty fine. How are you,
Fantastic.
Mr. Mayor?
Good. Thank you very much. It's great to be on today.
So, Mr. Mayor, before we get to the news of the day, you have an announcement.
Yeah, well, Meredith Winnick, who is the CFO of the City of Boston, today's her last day, and she's done a great job. She's worked for the city for 12 years, and we're replacing her with a gentleman by the name of David Sweeney, who's currently the CFO at the lottery for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And he's responsible right now for about $4.5 to $5 billion worth of assets over at the lottery. He started his career in public service working as an analyst for then-Speaker Ways and Means Chair Bob DeLeo. He worked his way up to the head of the budget, and then he went over with the Speaker for a year in the Speaker's office, and then he went over to the lottery, and he's the CFO over there. And I'm excited about David coming in. He's a great resume, great backgrounds, and he's going to be great for the city.
What's he do, and why should people in Boston care who the CFO is? What's the job?
Oh, I mean, I'll tell you, the CFO is one of those, you know, every job is important. We talk about every job is important, the superintendent of schools and the BRA director. But ultimately, to make the city succeed, it comes down to dollars and cents and making sure, because it's the taxpayers' money that funds our city, it's all taxes, and we need to make sure that we spend every dollar and every penny correctly. So he is going to be responsible for making sure that we keep a AAA bond rating that we have in Standard & Poor's and Moody's right now. He's also going to be responsible for, as we do developments, meaning city developments with new schools and new libraries and buildings and the budget, he's responsible for all of that. He's also responsible to say no to me. He needs to say no to me when I'm looking to do certain things, and if it's not feasible and not economical, he has to say no to me, and that's an important piece to have somebody who will do that. I don't need yes people when it comes to the money in the city. I need people who will push me and make sure that if I make a decision, that might mean something taken away from somewhere else.
Is he going to be selling lottery tickets out of his office at City Hall, or is it?
I think his last scratch ticket's next Friday.
Okay, we're talking to Mayor of the City of Boston, Marty Walsh. Speaking of dollars and cents and money for the city, the big news today is the firefighters in Boston.
Yep.
They're going to vote on this next week, 18% raise over 6 years, going to cost the city about $92.4 million, assuming the firefighters.
Yeah, that's all in. That's all the salary that they would get as firefighters. So when I saw that figure today, $92 million, I laughed. But that's what the salary they're going to make over a six-year period. You know, the contract expired 3 years ago.
Yep.
In the city, and the prior contract was settled through an arbitration, which I think the figure might have been a six-year contract, 33% over 6 years through arbitration. We were able to sit down with the union, Richie Paris and myself, and I actually sat at the table a couple of times with his team, and we were able to come up with some language. In about 20 hours, we negotiated a contract. We got some good language, reform language for the city. We got 18.8% over 6 years for the fire department, for the firefighters, which is a nice increase for them. You know, they have a tough job. They've had a very, very difficult month, the fire department. And I'm very grateful that we were able to avoid arbitration. Actually, this contract negotiation started prior to me because there were 3 years without a contract, so it started before me. And it's a commitment I made in the campaign that I will negotiate and do everything I can to avoid arbitration. And by avoiding arbitration in this particular case, it saved the taxpayers of Boston $1 million in legal fees.
The arbitration itself.
Arbitration, but $1 million in legal fees is roughly what the cost was of the last arbitration. And I don't want to pay lawyers $1 million to negotiate a contract.
I read in the Globe this morning, Mayor Walsh, as you just said, you were at several of the negotiations. Yeah. How much direct dealing was there between you and the local president, not in sessions, to try to get this thing done?
Basically, we left it in the room. We made a deal. We made an agreement that whatever was discussed in the room stays in the room. And when we were outside of that room, we did never discuss the contract. Mm-hmm. I've seen Richie at a lot of different events, particularly with the loss of the two firemen. But we left it at the table. And there's one point that we had a pretty somewhat little bit of a heated exchange at the table. But when we walked out, we left that heated exchange inside.
What was that about?
About numbers, about the numbers of what we're looking for here. And what happens is... you know, when you walk out of that room, you have to leave it there. And when the contract was done, I was criticized by media for not disclosing the terms of the agreement. But our agreement was that when we came up with a solution, an agreement here, that until he had the chance to bring it to his membership, it would stay with me and my team. And then we had a conversation over the weekend that he said he had an initial meeting with the membership, explained to enough of the members to know what the contract was, so we're able to go public with it.
And by the way, our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to speak directly to Mayor Marty Walsh.
You know, one of the things you hear all the time, and some people are opposed to this and some people think it's great, is the whole parity that the police officers and the fire department have to end up at the same place. Now, under Mayor Menino, the firefighters ended up with a 25%. I mean, excuse me, the police ended up with a 25% increase. So that's obviously, at least in terms of pure salary, higher than – that's not parity.
I think just negotiating for my parity is a dangerous way to negotiate. It's about fairness. I think parity makes it very difficult because, you know, parity doesn't work both ways. If you get a contract that's negotiated less than someone else, then the parity means you negotiate less. And I think it's a difficult way to negotiate a contract. And as a labor official, I think it's hard to negotiate a parity. Now, there is something called coalition bargaining that they do with the state, with the MBTA generally. Local 589, which is the common union, they'll negotiate a contract, and when they negotiate the contract, the other unions at the T will generally fall in line with that contract number. That doesn't happen necessarily in the city of Boston. It does a little bit, and I think that, you know, I think coalition bargaining is not a bad thing if you can get the people at the table to come up with a fair compromise for everyone.
We're talking to Mayor Marty Walsh. You can talk to him at 877-301-8970. You can tweet questions, as a bunch of people already have, to at BOS Public Radio. My assessment of this, Mr. Mayor, was that when you were elected, and I know there was many people assessed your first 100 days, even though you didn't go out of your way because the anniversary was obviously the anniversary of the marathon bombings. My assessment was this was the most important test for you. Did you see it? I mean, in light of the fact that the primary argument against you by editorialists and John Connolly, your opponent, was that you were a captive of public employee unions. And the question was, will you continue to be a captive? Your argument obviously was no one can better bring them to the table fairly than you because that's the culture, not public employees, but unions you come from. Did you not see this as the most important test for yourself in the first few months?
The whole campaign, I felt that I feel, and I still feel, that I can negotiate any contract with anyone and come up with an agreement as long as I have two willing parties. I think for public perception, this was an important negotiation for us. I'm sure there'll be some critics of this saying, oh, you should have got this or should have got that. You know, if you compare it to the last agreement, it's 33% versus 18.8. Big difference. And it varies. It varies as far as training certificates that firefighters have. But I think the fact that I was able to sit down at a table, and it's a mutual respect for both sides. And you have to have that respect on both sides. If you're in a negotiation and one side doesn't respect the other at all, you're not going to get a contract.
But I mean, you said some people perceive this as the most important. How did you perceive? Did you not think that in light of the arguments that were used against you in the campaign, that this was a major test for you? If you came in with a number, for example, that 25.4, the higher number you mentioned because of all the other things attendant to that, were you not saying to yourself, I got to show that I can walk the walk, not just talk the talk?
Not really, because if I govern like that, then that means everything I've done or said, I have to compare it to something that's happened in the past. And I think, you know, you just got to do the job. And when I started this almost 4 months ago, I had a very different feel than I have today. 4 months later, I feel very comfortable in the job. I feel like our team is starting to gel. I'm getting a good feel in there. And I think with this negotiation, we're only going to get stronger as we go on. The first contract we actually solved was the librarians that no one's talking about, but to allow branches to be open on the weekends. And that was a big win, and people don't realize it was a huge win for the city, for certain people, but you know, we were able to get that negotiation done. We're able to get the firefighters now resolved, and we have two of the last, there were three police unions still out there. There's two done now. We have one police union left, and we have EMTs. So of all the public employee contracts that are out there, we have two left to negotiate, and the rest of them are all settled through 2016 into 2017.
Hey, just one last thing on this for me. I mean, you've been doing these negotiations for a long time when you were with the building trades before you became the mayor and stuff. You know, one of the things when people are, we're living a long time now, which is a great thing, but it's not such a great thing because
it's a great thing.
It's a great thing, but public pensions when you can retire in your 50s and you can start collecting, it's a strain because, as you know, all around the country, cities and states are really being buried under pension costs. You ever given a thought to the idea of people retiring in their 50s but beginning to collect their pension 62, 65, like people do in the private sector?
It's difficult to do that because then what will people do? You know, one thing I'm concerned about in this country is that we're getting away from pensions, not just public pensions, but private pensions.
And, yes, we are.
And what's going to happen here is if people don't save money, and who can save money today? Everything's expensive. We're setting up a system where we're going to have to put in programs and welfare programs for senior citizens. And you know, there's this move against, it's funny, the people moving against pensions are the people that have nice 401ks and nice trust funds built up. The average person in the street doesn't have that. So, you know, you need to have something put away for when you retire. My example is my father. My father was a laborer. He worked 35, 40 years as a construction laborer. Thank God he collected his pension for about 13 years. My father passed away 4 years ago, and his pension transferred over to my mother. You know, if my mother didn't have that, and didn't have, you know, two sons, you know, God knows what's going to happen. So I think we have to be very careful in this country when we talk about getting rid of pensions. And when it comes to public employee pensions, I think we have to, as legislators and as mayors, have to do a better job of making sure those funds are funded and not borrow against those funds. You know, in up at Beacon Hill when I was there, you know, one of the reasons why we're in the situation we're in is that we borrowed against the pension funds. You can't borrow against the pension funds. The talk in Social Security, we borrow against Social Security. That's not money to be borrowed against. That's money that should be put in the bank and invested, and the return on the investment should be paying off the current pensions. That's the way it's supposed to happen. And we're actually on pace in City Hall to be funded, I think it's 2024, I think it is, fully funded of our pension system. And my goal is to get that pension system fully funded so when I'm done as mayor, I'm not leaving something to my predecessor, to my successor, that's an unfunded liability.
877-301-8970. One last thing before we get to the calls, and we will. And again, you can tweet in questions at BOS Public Radio, and you can email questions to the mayor at bprwgbh.org. Just a reflection on the marathon for a minute. What's your takeaway from the 21st, the marathon day itself, not the week that led up to it, not the anniversary of the bombings, but the 21st?
Marathon day, in my opinion, was absolutely incredible in the city of Boston. From the beginning in the morning, when I got up to go to the marathon, we started the day at City Hall Plaza. We did a little ceremony. There was excitement in the city. We went to the finish line. I was at the finish line for about 6 hours on Marathon Monday. I watched, you know, obviously, I was saying to people throughout the week that we were there really to watch the other runners, not the elite runners, but to see that the women's race set a course record, which is incredible. The men's race, Meb won the marathon.
Can you say Meb's last name?
No.
neither can I.
Meb winning the marathon and being an American citizen was just spectacular. And then watching, you know, standing there watching the different people cross the finish line for a whole host of reasons, running with shirts of you know, names, Crystal Campbell's name on it, Lindsay Liu's name on it, Sean Collier's name on it, Team MR8 for Martin Richard. Seeing other people running for the firemen that died, seeing people just, I watched one guy in particular, he's about 100 yards away from the finish line, and he just had nothing left. His legs were going, his arms were going, his head, you could just tell by watching him. And he made it, we were screaming, he made it across the line and just went down. those stories, seeing people pick people up and taking them across the finish line, just the inspiration there. And then standing at the podium with survivors next to me, understanding, you know, 1 year ago today, and I was thinking about it, just their strength. So it's just an incredible day. There's still a buzz in Boston. I mean, every day, yesterday I was sitting in my office looking out the window and I saw three or four or five people walking around marathon jackets. There's just so much excitement. And I think the BAA did an incredible job of this marathon. And really the weekend leading up to it, they had the 5K where 10,000 people ran in it. They had the 1 mile survivor walk. They had the relay for the young kids, which Henry Richard won. I was proud to see his team won.
Yeah, it was great. Great picture of him.
Older brother of Martin, for those who don't know.
It was great. He ran. You could just see him running like nothing was going to stop him.
That was great.
And then the marathon itself. And we had a pasta dinner at City Hall the night before on Easter Sunday night. And people from all over the world. And there was a couple there from Iceland that came in. And there was two people. And they said that they weren't able to finish the marathon. And I'm giving them dinner, and they said, you know, I'm here because this is what we want to finish the marathon. Then four people came by, and then a couple more people came by from Australia, I think it was, and they didn't finish the marathon. So all these people from around the world came back to run a marathon. Incredible.
It's great.
Wow.
Let's take some calls. 877-301-8970. Marty Walsh, the mayor of the city of Boston, is with you and us until 1 o'clock, so give him a buzz. Mr. Mayor, take it away.
How about Paul from Milton?
Hey, Paul.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you? Congratulations, Mr. Mayor. Very impressive. And as an outsider watching you, particularly at the marathon day, that was really an excellent presentation. The whole, very moving. My question is really practical, but it does tie into the tragedy a year ago. And that's whether you would consider reopening Charles Street as a two-way street rather than one. When Kevin Hagan White was mayor of Boston and lived in Beacon Hill, you should probably know, he made that one way coming out from the Charles Circle. It always concerned me that, you know, that is a direct route to all the hospitals, Mass General in particular, right at the Circle. And I don't know this to be a fact, but after the bombing, I wondered whether the ambulance had to go all around Beacon Hill to get to the hospitals, if that's what they're going to do, or get on Sturrow Drive. It would have been a direct, quick access if Charles Street was two ways, as it had been originally.
Yeah.
It just seems, because it's so close to the hospitals, that it's really needs to be considered as a two-way street open to the hospitals.
We got it, Paul. Thank you so much for your call. Mr. Mayor.
Paul, I'm assuming that the folks that live in Beacon Hill right now are probably jumping to the phone. So we'd have to talk to them about opening it to two-way. I think it's a tough street. It's a tight street as a one-way coming down. And, you know, this is the first time it's been brought to my attention. I know that they certainly don't want to shorten any routes to Mass General or any other hospitals in the city. But I don't know if it makes sense to turn Charles Street into a two-way. I think the traffic that would be put on that street by doing that would be really probably make it more difficult to travel down than it being a one-way.
We're going to raise another traffic issue in a little bit. Let's go back to the phones, 877-301-8970. We're with the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh. Mr. Mayor.
How about Bob in Melrose?
Hey, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
Hey, Paul. Listen, Mr. Mayor, I just... You kind of ruffled my feathers a little bit when you were talking about the private sector and their nice 401ks in comparison with pension. I think you and I both know that there's a huge difference between a pension and a 401k, right?
No, what I was trying to suggest there, and let me clarify that, is some of the people that are looking to get rid of pensions don't understand, I don't think, fully what a pension means to a family. A lot of companies now seem to be getting away from the pension system, and I think that's... You know, 401ks work, certainly. People have the ability to be able to earn money, but we were talking about pensions in general, and I don't like seeing the idea of pensions going away in this country. I think it's setting us up down the road for some problems. That's what I meant by that.
For the vast majority of the people in the country, pensions disappeared 25 and 30 years ago, so it seems inherently unfair.
They're still collecting them today, though.
What's that?
Some people are still collecting those pensions today. They have gone away, and I think
mostly the public sector, I'm afraid. So, but like, what I'm saying is, it seems inherently unfair that the private sector should fund somebody from, say, 55 to, I don't know, 90 now, I mean, they made sense when people were living to be 70.
If they work for the work for the company, don't they deserve that? If they work for a company and that's the terms of their employment?
No, no, absolutely. I agree that there should be pensions, but now there's only pensions for pretty much for the public sector. So you can't be surprised when people kind of get annoyed, all right, that, you know, public sector employees can retire between 55 and 60, and yet most private sector people have to work until they're now, 75?
Let's clarify that. Public sector employees can retire sometimes earlier, but they don't get fully funding in their pension. So it's a percentage base. It's really based on years of service and your age. So they change from sector to sector. But when people talk about pensions, when they talk about public employees retiring, oftentimes that public employee will be collecting 40 to 60% of their pension when they retire at the age of 65. It's not like they're getting what people think are these exorbitant benefits to pensions.
Well, Bob, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You were in the middle of a squabble. I don't know if you'd characterize it that way, but you are with the Casino Commission and its chair, Steve Crosby. A couple of things. One, you've accused him of bias, and I'd like to suggested that he recuse himself from the Eastern Massachusetts decision, which is currently between Everett and Revere. And secondly, you are seeking host status, and what goes along with host status, obviously, is the ability of there to be a vote in a neighboring community. Well, you wouldn't put it this way, Mayor Walsh, if you are granted host status, mm-hmm. essentially the likelihood is good that you have killed a casino in Eastern Massachusetts. The assumption is, I think it's a fair assumption, East Boston again would vote no, this time against Revere. Charlestown would probably vote no against Everett. And so have you thought about the potential consequence of getting what you want? And all you voted for the casino bill when you were a legislator, yep. and the ultimate outcome being no casino in Eastern Mass at all?
I voted for a casino bill that was built into that bill that gave people, neighborhoods, the opportunity to vote whether or not they want a casino in their neighborhood. And that was clearly stated in the bill. In the case of these two, I keep hearing from both communities that people want a voice in this. I think if a casino, if this were to be deemed host status in both and both communities voted it down, I don't view me as getting rid of the bill. I view the people of those communities voting down something that they don't want in their backyard. And I feel very strongly about the fact that, you know, we are a community. Both communities are affected, going to be affected greatly by casinos, whether it's traffic or impact on businesses or impact on employment, impact on a whole bunch of different areas. So we're fighting to make sure that we have an opportunity so people of Boston have a voice. My concern around the commission is that they've made statements about Boston being a surrounded community without allowing Boston to make the argument, the fact that we feel that we're a host community.
And we should explain to people that surrounding is, it gives you fewer rights than being granted host status.
Yep.
And that's what the
big issue is. You know, surrounded community agreement, there's really, in all reality, we probably could negotiate as the same as a host community status, minus the real estate taxes and minus a vote. I mean, mm-hmm. if we could negotiate something like that. But I just think that the commission is an impartial, they're supposed to be an impartial body of government that have clearly made statements against Boston, have been constantly saying that we're whining, which I think is absurd. And I think that as chair of that commission, you cannot make statements like that. It's like a judge in a case making predetermined ruling whether somebody's guilty or innocent or not, and then talking about that person. You can't do that. The job of that commission is supposed to be an impartial body to be able to listen to all sides of the argument, and that's a problem. And the way that I feel this has been handled up till today, in the beginning it was handled great, and then somewhere along the road it went bad. Now, we also have had a change in leadership in the city of Boston, where we have two different people, Mayor Menino before me, and now my administration, and we're making sure that I'm doing what's right for the interests of the people of Boston.
So a couple of quick follow-up questions, then we'll get back to the calls at 877-301-8970. If Steve Crosby does not recuse himself, and it seems unlikely that he would Boston not appear at the hearing because of his perceived bias?
We're not sure yet. We're still having discussions, negotiations about what our next step is.
And if he, and if they deny host status, whether it's with Crosby or without, they deny host status. Is it likely the city would sue to get host status?
Again, that's something we have to discuss internally, and we've had some discussions about what the process is and what we think might happen or what might not happen. So we're looking at all those different options.
And the final thing is, I appreciate what you said before, Mayor Walsh, about, you know, obviously it's not you or the city killing casinos in eastern Massachusetts. It's following the rules that the legislature passed. But you would agree, I assume, with what I said. The likely outcome, if you are granted host status, is a no vote in Charlestown and a no vote in East Boston, right?
I'm not sure about that. I think the fact that both proponents would have to put on a new case in each of those towns, and in the case of, well, actually, Mohegan Sun is his first time to do it and win, they would have to explain to the communities what the benefits would be to those communities, and they'd have to negotiate a deal with the city, and then we'd be proposing that to the voters, and the voters would be voting that up and down. And I think that in the deal with, Caesars Palace and then Suffolk Downs, there was some great community benefits in that deal. $45 million infrastructure improvements, a lot of money going back to the city, a lot of money going back to the East Boston community directly. And I think what might have happened there was other outside influences that got involved. But again, it's going to be up to the voters to look at the package and see if they agree with it or don't agree with it.
Okay. So what do you think, how much money would Boston need to get, Mayor Walsh? You're a good negotiator to get make it enough money to make it happen.
I'll let you know in a couple of weeks.
Let's go back to the phones. He's Mayor Marty Walsh, Mayor of the City of Boston. Mayor.
How about Tom?
Tom from North Andover. Take it away, Tom.
Hello, Mr. Mayor. It's an honor to speak with you. I just have a quick question. The Boston Globe has recently reported on a number of unprovoked attacks on the streets of downtown Boston near the Common on Tremont Street. On, like, a Wednesday night, I think there were three attacks. On that Friday night, I think there was an attack on a man and a woman. I was just wondering if there's any if you have any plans to make the streets safer.
Yep.
in such things like more police presence on the street, not only to catch these things after they catch the people after it happens, but to prevent these things from happening in the first place.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. We actually did do that. We increased our police presence down there. Those were two very strange circumstances that what happened. The Commissioner Evans called me after the Wednesday night attack. There was 12 individuals running around, just kind of jumping people and causing all kinds of problems. The police were able to arrest three individuals that night. And then two nights later, they were able to, made a couple more arrests on the Friday night, people slashing tires. And we have increased our police presence in downtown Crossing. Our streets are safe. It's very unfortunate what happened down there, but we're all over it. And with our gang units following also to try and identify some of the other folks that were there and to send a very strong message. But we are putting as many police as we can on the street. We have a new class coming out of the academy. They're in the academy right now, so we're going to be able to put some more police out in the street. I actually like seeing police out in the street. We put money in this year's budget, next year's budget, I should say, to put on more police officers. We're right at the limit where we have to be. I certainly would like to increase the numbers of police at some point, because people in every neighborhood in the city of Boston, including downtown, love seeing walking beats and love seeing people out in the street. And we don't have the numbers yet to do that in every neighborhood, but we will be there.
Before we leave the subject matter, thank you for the call, Tom, and take a quick break. You've also been pretty involved in gun elimination discussions of late, from the gun buyback that was announced, I guess, several weeks ago, maybe a month ago, to this forum that happened the last couple of days. Give us a quick summary of where we are on that issue.
Yeah, we had a gun summit yesterday in Boston. It was the first time that we had our partners from New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, actually Connecticut and Rhode Island were there in the room, talking about guns and trafficking of guns from the north into Boston, as well as trafficking of drugs from Boston up into Massachusetts, up into the north. So we had a very good dialogue about talking about how do we work together across agencies. ATF was there. United States Attorney was there. Carmen Ortiz herself was there. Martha Coakley was there, the Attorney General. So we did a lot of discussion about how we continue a discussion and work on stemming the tide in gun violence. We also announced yesterday that we're going to be partnering with Harvard University and doing a study around gun violence and tracing guns, how they get to our streets. And then we're going to continue the gun summit and continue working on that. That's one of the things that we've done in response to guns. But we also institute a gun buyback program that people said is controversial. And since we instituted the gun buyback program about a month ago, we've taken 273 guns off the streets of Boston, 120 of them semi-automatics, which is a big deal. And we also, the police in themselves, have taken an additional 179 by traffic stops. So we've taken over 400 guns off the street this year, and we're going to continue to be diligent on that. You know, our shootings are, I shouldn't say this, I'll jinx myself, down this year, but down isn't good enough. We want our shootings to be eliminated.
And we should just say, before you go ahead, just say on the gun buyback deal, are you going to mention
I was going to mention the guns, the illegal guns, where they're coming from,
before
which
you
is
get
kind
to
of surprising.
Though, does the deal still exist that if you surrender an active gun, you still get a $200
gift card? Yeah, you get a $200
gift
card. Yeah, we're keeping that going, and we're lining up. We're going to keep that going for a long time. We just want to continue to get these guns off, and we're doing a PSA, public service announcement, with one of the Celtics, I believe, taped it yesterday, and Bradley, and he's going to be we're going to be playing that out starting this weekend.
You know what was really surprising to me, though, is this story in the paper today, in the Globe today, that almost half the illegal guns seized and traced in Boston came from manufacturers and dealers in Massachusetts. Yeah. I think most of us assumed that people going to New Hampshire, where they have, you know, you can go to these gun shows, or Vermont or Maine, but
I assume
we have tough laws.
I assume the same thing with that, and you know, one of the things, I think the legislature is working on some legislation now about locking guns up and doing better security. A lot of the guns that are in the street are stolen out of people's houses, and they don't report them for whatever reason. So, you know, we need to make sure that if a gun's stolen from your house, report it so we can track it. But we do, this study that we're going to do with Harvard is going to really track down where these guns come from, meaning we're going to find out where they come from, how they get into young people's hands.
We're taking a break. Okay, we are taking a break, but we're going to stay with the mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh, until 1 o'clock and get as many as your calls and questions and some Twitter and Facebook stuff before 1 o'clock. Stay with us.
Discover the real-life stories of the African-American soldiers who populate the Bronze Civil War Memorial across from the Massachusetts State House. All fought, some died, now they are immortal. Today at WGBHnews.org.
I'm Kara Miller, and every week on Innovation Hub, I talk with researchers and visionaries who are crafting our future. Join us as we look at how the world is changing on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesley.edu. And the Worcester Art Museum, presenting Nights, featuring works from the Higgins Armory Museum Collection and the Worcester Art Museum. This new experience celebrates the rich history and artistry of this acclaimed collection. WorcesterArt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Most importantly, he is the mayor of the city of Boston. Now, Mr. Mayor, before we get back to the calls at 877-301-8970, I want to know if your police commissioner is a man of his word. He was here recently talking about the security. And I made a proposal, speaking about Charles Street, I made a proposal about what I thought should happen to Newbury Street, not just closed to vehicular traffic for one day, but an ongoing basis, at least during the summer. Here's what Commissioner Evans had to say.
If the business would want that, I think it would be great. But I agree with you. If it's not double parking down there, it takes some days. And we work our hardest along with the transportation department, but it's hard to get down there anyway.
It's terrible. Terrible.
You know, Mayor Walsh has done a great job, and, you know, he's open to any suggestions. And when I leave here, Jim, I'll make sure he knows this is your suggestion, not mine.
Now, we want to know what stage of the decision-making process is this now, Mr. Mayor?
Well, you know, he did bring it up to me, actually. He talked
no,
about,
he did not.
Yeah, he did, because he came on here a couple weeks before that, talked about Uber, I think.
Yeah, he did, actually.
And I got a lot of calls on that.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting, because on Saturday, Newbury Street was shut down, and you know, there was a lot of people on Newbury Street. I think it would be difficult to do to some degree because of the traffic would be put onto other streets, but it's something worth looking at, or at least looking at certain parts of Newbury Street to possibly shut down. I think that the businesses might welcome it as long as there's a lot of foot traffic, but we'd probably have to talk to the businesses and do a study to make sure it doesn't affect them in an adverse way as well, because a lot of their people driving down, they see a business, they stop the car, they pull over, they go in. That's part of the allure, too. But it is a very difficult street to get down.
Well, you can't park, you can't drive, you can't do anything on Newbury Street. That's the basis for my suggestion.
If you get lucky, you can park.
Yeah.
You can, exactly.
Yeah, sometimes. You get the little tags, put the little tags in the meter thing.
You got to watch the lights and see when somebody's lights the bike.
I understand.
Light.
Well, thank you for your consideration, at least, of the issue.
One last thing for me, too, before we get back to the calls. A big thing during your campaign, you talked about having the city, your administration, the people that you hire, reflect the city of Boston.
Yep.
Now you're getting criticized for withholding diversity records. What's the story, Mr. Mayor?
Yeah, there was a story in the paper, The Globe, the other day, done that was not real happy about. It wasn't about withholding records. It was about how we actually keep records in the city of Boston. And there's a whole bunch of different ways of keeping, when I say keep records, keeping people's race. In some departments, people can self-identify themselves as a race. They can check off on the application what race they are. In other places, we don't have that information, so we do it by visual assessment.
So, and you walk around to offices and look at who's black, white,
that's
Asian?
That's past practice, yes.
Really?
And I didn't feel comfortable, and I don't feel comfortable, and I think most people agree with me, that we're going to release records based on visual assessment. So what we're doing is we're working on the policy to make sure the policy is uniform across. And actually, the federal government is frowning upon the fact of visual assessment as well. So we're going to bring us in line with what the government requires. I am not opposed to releasing any records to anyone. And we will release the records that we have accurate numbers on. But as far as visual assessment, I find that insulting. And I find it, and some people, I think, agree with me, discriminatory.
The Globe's criticism, I should say. I didn't see if there was an editorial, but in the story itself, there were essentially two criticisms. One, you said at some point you release it, but with no timeline. I'm curious to know if there is one now. And they go on to say, Globe analysis of payroll records found that in Walsh's first month in office, his hires were overwhelmingly white and predominantly male, intimating from that. They don't say it, but I think the intimation is the reason you don't want to release it is because it's going to show that you're mostly hiring white guys.
Yeah, which isn't true. I think the first month, I think the number is 16 people I hired in the first month. And I felt that story was another story that was, not a good story. But anyway, it doesn't matter. That's fine. We're going to be fine.
How about the timeline deal?
Timeline, we just found this out literally about 10 days ago. So we're working on it now. And we're talking, looking through all cross agencies. We have about 17,100 employees working for the city. Some of the folks that work for the city have self-identified, and we have the records, and others we don't. So we're trying to figure out what departments have and what departments don't, release the information as we get it.
By the way, we have gotten a couple of emails saying you've had some problems with the phone. Keep trying. Some calls are getting through. But if you're having a problem, continue to try 877-301-8970.
We also have a question from Shakira on Twitter. She wants to know what you're going to do about rent control in the city of Boston. There is none now.
Well, it's eliminated on the ballot. Yeah, about 15 or 20 years
there is
ago.
None. And we're not looking at, I'm not looking at bringing rent control back. But what we are doing is looking at, we put a task force together. Sheila Dillon, the chief of housing, is looking at creating more workforce housing in the city of Boston and middle-income housing. In Boston, we do a very good job of building high-end rental, which is great because the funding is there and banks are willing to invest. Low-income housing, sometimes we can do a good job when there's grants and tax credits. But when it comes to moderate-income housing or workforce housing, there really is no ability or no pot of money to be able to put into it public money. And there's not a big desire on behalf of developers. So we put together a task force to actually look at this issue. This is a big issue for Boston. This is a big issue, I think, for New York, Chicago, L.A. How do you keep and retain your young talent here in the city? And how do you make the city affordable for people to stay? So it's something that we are looking at. We're also looking at vacant lots around the city of Boston. And can we create housing on those 2- and 3-family housing in neighborhoods so first-time home buyers have a chance to buy a home? And then also look at the possibility of kind of holding rents at certain fees. So you give somebody an opportunity to buy a home at a certain cost, that the rents can't go. It doesn't become an income property, at least for 10 years or so.
What's wrong with rent control?
I just think it's a tough precedent. It hurts. I mean, right now, rent control would be difficult because of the cost that people have paid for housing, and to be able to get their return just to pay their mortgage, I think it would be a very difficult situation to put in place.
Let's go back to the phones. They appear finally to be working properly. Mr. Mayor, it's up to you. Well, actually, I take that back. But go ahead. There's still
gone?
A couple of calls. A couple just disappeared again. But go ahead, Mr.
How about
Mayor. Take
Al?
It away. Hi, Al. Or AJ. Sorry.
Oh, AJ. I'm sorry.
From AJ. Hey, AJ.
How are you?
Excellent.
I just had a question, actually, about the gun summit,
yep.
the buyback. I wanted to know how how many guns do you actually predict or have actually been seized that were criminally owned or that were on the streets owned by a criminal that came in and turned one in? Because, you know, I mean, you have to have a license to have the thing, and if you didn't, if you were walking in with a gun and didn't have it, you would already be breaking the law, and let alone a guy that killed somebody or potentially robbed somebody or sold drugs or something with this gun. You know what I mean? I just don't see them walking in and turning in a gun. I feel like it's more of a way for people to be able to get money to clean out their closets.
Well, first of all, the guns that we're taking have to be Boston guns, and they have to be a good gun. When they did the gun buyback program back in 2006, they collected about 1,000 guns. Some of the guns they collected were old antique rifles, old antique shotguns, and things like that. So this program, we've designed it a lot differently. And also, it's an anonymous program, so people can drop them off at certain community centers or the police department, or can, a police officer actually will go pick it up. They will run ballistics on the gun just to make sure it wasn't in a murder or in a serious crime. But for the most part, it's an anonymous program that the guns are dropped off. And we've taken, as I said, 273 guns off the street. And, you know, somebody says, well, what's the impact in the street? We never know. I mean, we don't know if one of those guns that are 273 would have killed somebody. So they're out of the hands of people. They're out of the hands of young people. And a lot of parents have been very supportive of this program as well, possibly finding them, bringing them in.
AJ, thanks for the call. So when you read that former Mayor Bloomberg, Medford kid, of New York City is going to spend at least $50 million of his own money to create essentially an anti-NRA to spend money in local races to elect people who are pro additional gun control, specifically in the beginning, background checks. Does he have a chance in you-know-what of ever taking on the NRA in Congress?
No, probably not. But I'll tell you, you know, I think we get all caught up in this thing. And every time I come on the radio or talk about this, the gun owners will come after me saying, what's wrong with you? My concern isn't the legal gun owner. My concern is the illegal guns on the street. People going, whether they're stolen guns in Massachusetts or somehow these guns hit the streets and young people get hold of them, or people go up to New Hampshire and buy guns and bring them down here where there's no real checks. It's about the illegal guns. And when it comes to legal gun owners, if the legislature or the Congress puts additional laws just to make sure they're safe, I don't see what the big problem with that is. You know, it's about security and safety as well. So I think the issue here in Boston is less about the NRA and more about getting these illegal guns off the street. And people that are legitimate gun owners, good luck to you. You can own your gun. It's the law. But you know, don't deter us from trying to stop getting these illegal guns off the street.
But you're not hopeful about the effort by Bloomberg?
I wouldn't put anything past Mayor Bloomberg. You know, he's just done some incredible things. As mayor in New York, I went down there at the end of his term and saw the way he has his office set up and what he's done in the city.
Is he physically still in the middle?
He didn't take an office.
It
was incredible what I saw down there. And then the data dashboards, the idea that he had, I actually took that idea and expanded upon it. But some of the things that he did in New York were incredible. And I would not put anything against this man. He's a very determined man. I met him once. But in the one time I met him, he made an impression on me. I met him for a half hour. And just the topics he spoke about. And he's really passionate about the guns. And we have some great people here, John Rosenthal and other folks that do a lot with guns. So I think that, you know, nothing's impossible. But the NRA lobby in the southern parts of this country is a very big lobby.
So you're going to move your desk out into the middle of City Hall?
Well, if I did, it's outside because we have nothing in the middle of City Hall.
Mayor Walsh, before I get back to the calls, you just mentioned John Rosenthal. 99% of us know John Rosenthal is the leader of Stop Handgun Violence. He's obviously got that huge, very powerful billboard on the Pike, which you see. He's also a developer, most people don't realize. And unlike your predecessor, who opposed any tax break to get his project going, you advocated for, it was $4.6
million? $4.6
million
over 6 years.
Yeah, explain briefly, if you can, we'll get back, why you thought what Menino thought was a bad idea was a good idea.
John Rosenthal has a project called the Fenway Center. He had some issues with, actually the city was sued by one of the local businesses down there because of the approval of this project. A $550 million five-building project that's going to create about 3,500 construction jobs as well as long-term jobs afterwards. It was an air rights project over the Mass Pike, and it was very close to being done. We sat down with John to make this deal happen. This is the first time in 32 years that the city of Boston has approved an air rights project over the Mass Pike since the Prudential Building. So pretty excited about that. He's done a lot. As far as a philanthropist, he's done incredible work. But as far as giving an opportunity to continue to grow that area, I don't think there was any opposition to that project down there by any abutters, any neighbors. So I wanted to make sure, when somebody says to me, you can't make it happen, I wanted to make this project happen, and we're able to make this happen in my first 100 days.
Let's go back to the phones. Mr. Mayor.
How about Mike in Boston?
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
Hello? Ooh. Hi, Mike. You're in a wind tunnel at City Hall, I assume. But go ahead, Mike.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm sitting in my living room. But okay. I do want to ask the mayor about East Boston. I read in the paper, there was an article on the 20th about the building boom in the number of parts of the city, including Dudley, and the South End and East Boston. Now, this is about the sixth time in 10 or 15 years I've seen an article about the Renaissance of East Boston. And my friend and I own a couple of pieces of property there. And so we're still waiting for this great Renaissance to happen there. And he and I had an argument. I think that people think it's too far away because there's a big body of water between the downtown and that part of Boston. And I live in the Fort Hill area, which is about as far away, but it's just hard to get people over there. Is this really going to happen?
Yeah, we've sat down, the BRA sat down with some proponents of the waterfront, and they're pretty close to working out some agreements over there. I think there's one of the issues that you have in East Boston is securing the financing and the price points for what the condos and what the rental units are going to cost over there. That's really the issue.
I see 1,900 to 3,300 for this new development that's actually going up now. It seems high.
And it makes it, but when you talk about building on the waterfront and the cost of construction, as far as the materials, it really depends upon what you get in. You know, it's hard to build housing, moderate income housing there because you don't have the ability with tax credits from the state or tax credits from the federal government and some money to be able to help you build those. So that's part of my housing task force. But I think you're going to see the East Boston waterfront over the course of the next, there's some development down there now, as you know. And you're going to see more development happening down there. Once the next project goes, you're going to see a trickle effect.
Mike, thank you kindly for the call. Ben tweeted the following question, and the John Hancock, I'm with him. Building an observation deck has been closed since 9/11. Is there any chance it will be reopened? Ben, thank you for the tweet. How about that, Mr. Mayor?
This is pretty funny. Yesterday, I got the same question in my office. And
Ben?
I don't think it was Ben. And actually, no, it might have been Ben. Ben, if you were on the Reddick chat we had yesterday.
We're going to talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, that was a question from yesterday. So it's something that was the first time brought to my attention. Didn't realize it was still closed. I certainly will ask to see what the situation was. I know after 9/11, a lot of buildings closed their towers, and since then have been open. I have no idea what the policy is, and let me look into it.
It also, were you ever up there in the old observation deck?
Oh, yes,
it is just
I think someone's office is up there now.
Well, I know you know that someone's office is up there. It's not mine, so don't think that's
no,
where she's going.
It's not my office. Before you go back to the calls, in case no one's calling about this, as you know, federal agents shut down Touch 106.1. It's a very popular station in the African American community in Grove Hall. What is your take on this? I mean, they are unlicensed, and that's the reason they were shut down. On the other hand, they've been very popular in the community.
I think there was some tax
issues. You've been on it, right?
Charles
Clemens, of course, who ran for mayor.
He ran for mayor. Yeah. I think they had some tax issues as well, but it's a very important piece to make sure that they, in the communities of color, that they have a radio station, a low-power radio station. It's something that my office is working on. I know Touch has, I believe, and I don't know a lot about it, Touch has some issues with the federal government itself, but we certainly need to make sure that there's a voice in the communities of color, and particularly in the Grove Hall area. There's a lot of great things happening in Grove Hall. We announced Wicked Free Wi-Fi the other day in the business district, and we're doing a lot of business development retail there, helping from the city. So we need to make sure that the black community has an outlet as far as radio.
You know, Charles Clemens was with us the other day, one of the co-founders. He was in the day that I think you were off. You are
I
off,
was. I missed
Marjorie.
It.
A couple of things. One, he acknowledged he owes the $17,000 fine to the federal government that he hasn't paid. In the story in the Globe about this, though, it mentioned that the governor was given, not a tip, was notified, I assume by the Justice Department, prior to this happening. Were you notified before? And what I found to be strange, and I would say somewhat troubling, is after the governor got notice, he apparently told Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney, please don't do this. And this is not, I'm not suggesting it, illegal is illegal. Obviously it is. It's not the biggest issue for the Justice Department to deal with. Do you find it odd that a governor would personally intervene, ask that the U.S. attorney step back, at least temporarily, and the U.S. attorney proceeds to raid this place anyway?
I mean, I think I don't find it odd, number one. And I think that in some cases, this radio station, it means more to the community than it does to the owners of the radio station. I think that one thing that probably should have happened, if possible, is have the federal government reach out to the governor's office about coming up with some type of payment plan for taxes, if that's the issue. If the issue is money, reach out to the governor to see if there's a way, or reach out to the mayor to see if there's a way to get this company on a payment plan, because I think that's the way to get your money resolved rather than shut it down, if that's the only reason. Again, I think the story is still unfolding.
Mr. Mayor, back to the phones, if you would.
All right, how about, looking, no women are calling me today.
Sorry, Mr. Mayor.
So it is what it is.
Let's go to, how about Steve in Roxbury?
Hello, Stephen.
Sure. Hi, Mayor Walsh. It's an honor to speak with you. I love your forward-looking administration and was really, really glad that some of your competitors in the mayoral race, that they are now working with you.
Yeah, the great people in the race.
One of them, Felix Arroyo, pioneered a piece of legislation called Invest in Boston,
yep,
which would hold some of the major investment banks accountable to really investing in jobs and in real economy in Boston. And I'm wondering what your plans are for implementing that, and also concerns for the safety of Boston's money there in some of the major banks that are investing in derivatives.
Thank you. That was the last piece of legislation that City Councilor Felix Arroyo passed, and he got it done pretty much almost on the last day of session. It's the law now in because it was over. I believe Mayor Menino vetoed it, and the council overrode the veto. It is the law in Boston, and we're working right now with our different agencies as we continue to set up our government here, the new government, not the new government, but the new administration. It wasn't an overthrow. Although maybe some people think it was. But we're working to make sure that what Felix promoted is successful.
Hey, Stephen, thanks for the call. You know, before you go, you mentioned in passing, I am obsessed, one of the things I'm obsessed with, this wicked Wi-Fi thing. Yeah. Tell people what this is and what the projection is, what the goal is, all this sort of thing.
Yeah, wicked free Wi-Fi. In 2006, the city of Boston proposed having Wi-Fi in the city of Boston. From 2006 to 2013, 2014, it didn't really happen. It was always a discussion. What we did when we took over, and it was a lot of the discussion in the campaign about having bad internet service throughout the city of Boston. There are dead zones in the city. So what we're doing, we're going to start with Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi, in the 20 Main Street districts, the first being Grove Hall, that we announced it the other day. So we actually turned it on. So as you go through Grove Hall, there's Wi-Fi there, and it'll help the businesses grow. But also, while the businesses also get the Wi-Fi, the residents in that neighborhood get the Wi-Fi. So it covers about 35,000, I believe, residences in that neighborhood. Our goal ultimately is to make sure that the city of Boston is wireless as far as internet access.
Whole city.
And we're going to get there. We're working on it now, and hopefully we'll get there. We're going to be announcing some more Wi-Fi, wicked-free Wi-Fi. I think, I'm not sure when the next one is, but we're going to the next business district. So we're going to hit all 20 Main Street districts. We're upgrading our wireless in schools. Our young kids, we have a program that they're practicing the park assessment test on Chromebooks in our schools. You know, technology is what the future is all about, and we need to continue to grow with technology.
You know, one of the many fascinating things I learned about you in an interview you gave to Reddit was that it's Frosted Flakes for you
Frosted
every
Flakes.
Morning.
I like Frosted Flakes. When I have milk in the fridge, it's Frosted Flakes.
Okay.
Sometimes I don't have milk in the fridge. I like Frosted Flakes.
It's not good for you, do you know that?
Well,
how your cavities?
They're all right.
Oh, good. Okay.
It's a little intimate, Marjorie. Hey, before you go, you wanted a woman questioner. You've got one from Twitter. Billy says, what are we doing about making Mattapan Square look better? It needs a facelift.
We are working on Mattapan Square, and hopefully I'm working very hard with the elected official, with Danny Cullinane, who's the state rep out there, as well as Charles Yancey, who's the city councilor out there. We're working on with the business district out in Mattapan. It's an area I campaigned an awful lot in Mattapan Square, and I made my commitment that we're going to be providing services. We actually started by putting more Hokies out there. Those are the people that are cleaning the streets. We actually added more Hokies on this year in the city of Boston. In Public Works, there was a spot open for chief of staff, and they have enough executives around them, so we eliminated the chief of staff role, took that money, put it back into the streets, so we have young people and people out there cleaning the streets. So I think the first thing you're going to see is a cleaner streets, and next thing, working with the businesses as far as growth, and we have some big plans for Mattapan Square.
Before you go, one last political question, Mr. Mayor. The Democratic State Convention is in June, yep. The Democratic primary for a variety of things, including governor, September. Are you going to get involved in either? Are you going to instruct delegates who to vote for in June? Are you going to endorse a Democrat before the September primary?
No, I'm probably going to stay out of the race for governor and lieutenant governor in the primary. I don't think, first of all, I'm still learning how to be mayor of the city of Boston, and I have a lot of work to do rather than be getting involved in the political race. And, you know, last year I spent my whole summer campaigning for being mayor of the city. So I'm going to let all the candidates have fun this year campaigning to be governor of Massachusetts.
That was right before the overthrow. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Leading up to the overthrow.
You don't look exhausted or anything. You look quite chipper. Maybe it's the frosted flakes. I don't know.
It might be the frosted flakes, yeah.
Are you not exhausted?
Some days you get tired. You know, you get tired at the end of the night. I watched the Bruins last night, and I was a little tired. I went into overtime. I was like, oh, God. And I was very happy when England scored the goal.
I saw you on Nesson the other night. You were very impressive, by the way. Doing a little interview.
Yeah, I wanted to talk hockey.
You were very impressive, I should say. Mr. Mayor, thanks. By the way, people still online. The phones finally worked fully. We'll give your number to the mayor's office if you stay on hold. If you send an email or a tweet, they'll all be forwarded to Mayor Walsh's office for response. Mr. Mayor, thanks much.
See you next month. Thank you
very much for being here. As the mayor just said, Mayor Marty Walsh sounds better to me. He joins on the last Friday of every month for Ask the Mayor. Thank you again for coming in, Mayor Walsh. Coming up, Emily Rooney joins us for Open Mic and her famous list of observations and obsessions. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
If there's a vehicle at home you no longer need, why not turn it into something everyone counts on? More great stuff on WGBH. It's possible through our vehicle donation program. All you need is a clear title, and we'll take care of the rest. We'll even handle the towing, and next year, you might just get a tax refund. To learn more, visit wgbh.org/cardonation.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Sullivan Tire and Auto Service, providing New England with auto service since 1955, offering over 60 auto service locations throughout New England. More information and locations available at sullivantire.com. And Dover Rug and Home, rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick featuring a squash club or doverrug.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Gingrich. We're going to be joined in a couple of seconds by Emily Rooney for Open Mic. Our Friday news quiz is coming at the bottom of the hour. In between, we're going to talk to you about a move, a pro-bug kind of move. Are you aware of this, Marjorie?
Emily's here.
Well, she is here. But in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk about how bugs are replacing cows in the diets of many people. But in the interim, joining us as she does every Friday at just about 1 o'clock for Open Mic, is Emily Rooney. Hello there, Emily.
Hey, Marge. Hey, Jim.
Hello, Emily.
So we're going to change the format a little. Ordinarily, it's you starting things off in these segments, Marjorie, with Emily. But we decided jointly, the three of us, that we would talk to you, essentially, Marjorie. Front page of the Boston Herald today, full page. He's no pen pal. Excerpts from a letter that apparently was dictated by Jared Remy, accused of the murder of his girlfriend and mother of his second child, obviously Jennifer Martell. Jail mail. Jared Remy rails on Harold's Egan. That would be you in Letter from Behind Bars. So what we thought we'd do is have you, for those who missed it, sort of describe the background, what exactly he said to you, and then the three of us would talk about it a little.
Well, I wrote a couple of columns that I guess Jared Remy didn't like. One of them was questioning why his parents, Jerry Remy and Phoebe Remy, would seek custody of their granddaughter since Jared Remy, of course, is awaiting trial for allegedly murdering the mother of that granddaughter. And Jerry Remy didn't like that. That's the dad, not the son who's in jail. Jerry Remy went on another radio station and said what I wrote was disgusting. So that was the first thing. And then I wrote another column saying that I thought Jerry Remy should step aside at Nessun, because from my reading of the facts in this case, there were, 18 arrests of this young man, Jared Remy, over 19 years. At some point, I think it would have been a good thing, instead of Jared Remy getting bailed and getting out of jail, where he wasn't even in jail very much, that he should have done some time in jail. And I thought the parents did not do him a service by letting him continue on this path. And so apparently that upset, those columns upset Jared Remy, and he wrote me a letter. The beginning of it was basically saying, leave my parents out of it, which is fine. I mean, he's entitled to say, leave my parents out of it. I wrote in the Boston Herald this morning. He's defending his mom and dad, and that's fine. But it got kind of nasty toward the end, talking about...
Why don't you, instead of characterizing, why don't you read as much as you can, yeah, without us getting in trouble, read the portions that were a little troubling, I think, to anybody who read it.
Well, I didn't really put them in the paper because they were obscenely laced, but he describes in sexual terms and detail what a lot of people say women do to hold on to their job. It was spelled J-O-B-E. By the way, there were unbelievable misspellings in this, but it was not written by Jared Remy. He said it was dictated to a friend. But he talked about what I did to hold on to my job in pretty vulgar terms. And then he's saying that I'm going to claim that he's verbally assaulting me in this letter. I mean, it was...
As someone to whom the letter was not addressed, namely me, I would say verbal assault is a fair...
But I thought the significant thing was obviously that I have upset Jared Remy, and I thought the significant thing about the way he went after me in kind of vulgar terms was, I think it was a little window into his reaction to people that upset him, particularly women. Mm-hmm. I am a woman, and he's beaten four girlfriends and has allegedly murdered a fifth. So I think it was a reaction into his anger and how he reacted.
Yeah, that was a great line you had here, Marjorie. He's actually trying to put words in your mouth. Oh, you're going to accuse me of verbally assaulting you. And you say, no, actually, what I was going to say is that this gave me a firsthand perspective on how Jared Remy treats women who make him angry, like the four women he beat and the fifth he allegedly slaughtered. I mean, exactly. I know the prison is a tough environment and your worst instincts are reinforced, but you really got to wonder in this case. This guy enlists the assistance of somebody who's clearly mentally deficient. I mean, not only verbally, but every other way. This guy, Big E, he calls himself. He's the one who allegedly transcribed or Jared Remy dictated it to him. That's a little unclear, because who knows how Jared Remy could very well be in solitary right now for assaulting another inmate a few weeks ago. So how this even came about is unclear. But the idea that Jared Remy would think this was a good idea, that he would enlist the help of this particular person who he has to know has these incredible deficiencies in his ability to speak the English language, you really got to wonder. And it goes right back to what you said in your column. I mean, did Jared Remy not get a high school education? Did he not get the basic, common decency or common sense approach, even while you were in prison, to how you approach things?
I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. What was bizarre about this is reporters, as you know, Emily, and maybe you've got some too, Jim, you get a lot of letters from prison, mostly people that want you to help them prove their innocence. This was a really weird letter.
Yes.
It was a letter that got increasingly angry. And, it was kind of scary what this guy's perspective on life is like. And I thought it was really significant that he didn't talk about Jennifer Martell, who is the mother of his child, who is dead, allegedly at his hands. He didn't say...
He had to know you were going to write about this. Or did he not? That's what I'm getting at.
And by the way, we should say, for those who are saying to themselves right now, I don't think you confirmed this before, but I want to...
No,
I want to make clear, for those who are saying, well, if it's not in his writing, I know it's him. The sheriff of Middlesex County, Peter Katuchin, before Marjorie and wrote about it in the Herald, wrote an accompanying story, verified that the source of this was, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I want people to know.
Yeah, no, it's from him. I mean, as you're correct, the sheriff, Peter Katushin, verified through his spokesperson for the Herald.
He didn't tell you how it came about, though, how he got access to this other inmate and how he dictated.
No, but they are entitled to send out letters.
Oh, absolutely.
And the letter was sent out with the number of the, not of Jared Remy, but of the other person.
His
inmate number, correct.
Let me make three observations, if I may. The first observation is you are unlike 99% of us in the media who have turned down dozens of media requests to talk about this today on television and elsewhere. Can I say this?
Sure.
Because you felt it was exploiting the situation. And by the way, I think you deserve commendation for doing that. It's a huge story, not only what happened with you, but obviously the big picture. That's number one. Number two, when someone is wildly angry spontaneously, I don't mean physically doing what he is alleged to have done, but if someone said these words to you in a fit of anger, if Jared Remy came upon you on the street, I would say it's appalling, disgusting, and he should be arrested. But I would also probably say he's an unstable person who just lost it on the spot. He dictated this.
Yes.
And then when his friend wrote it,
including
some disgusting remarks about you, he decided to take it from his friend. I assume he read it again, put it in an envelope, and sent it to you. So there was plenty of, opportunity to consider not doing this. Right?
Exactly.
Which suggests that there
is none. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And there's further underlines for me, and I'm not playing lawyer here, I'm just playing human being, further underlines the abomination that allowed him to be a free man until the night that he allegedly killed Jennifer Martell. I mean, this is a guy who is as scary as all of us thought he was being. Now you've seen it yourself.
And now I can't help but think, and I'm sure you've had the same thought, Marjorie, what did Jerry Remy think and Phoebe when they read this morning? I mean, are they running over to the prison and saying, what in the hell are you doing? Stop this. You can't be communicating like this. You're making it worse for me. You're putting me back in the spotlight. I mean, it's a horror show.
Well, you know, that was the other thing that I thought of reading this letter, is that he obviously has caused his mother and father unbelievable anguish. I mean, this can be no day at the beach for Jerry and Phoebe Remy. And never in this article does he even say, own up to the fact that he's the cause of their anguish. He's the reason why people are saying Jerry Remy should step down at Nessun. He has really hurt his father by his own actions. And he talks about people taking responsibility for their own actions. He may now, because of this alleged murder, having to take responsibility for the first time, but he doesn't own up to what he did to his parents. While he's talking about, leave my parents out of this. Well, his parents wouldn't be in this if not for him.
One or two last quick things, and we'll move on from this. What I am obsessed with is, Marjorie, and I think Emily both know, and I have a feeling you didn't even do this today, Marjorie. I made the mistake, which I always make, of reading the comments.
Oh, I did too.
On your column. And I have to say that I don't want to be more hyperbolic than is appropriate. Some of these people are as scary as
same spelling
Jared
problems.
Remy.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe 50% of the comments don't talk about Jared Remy.
No.
They assault you.
Again.
Yeah. In ways that are just gross. I mean, a subhuman species of people who sit down, decide to hit send on these
I truly
comments.
Believe T-R-U-L-L-Y.
Well, you're concerned about
brain
power. The viciousness is just, it is staggering. And I like the fact that there's comment. It gives you an opportunity to get a sense of the world. But at least this subset of the world is absolutely frightening.
I just want to say, yesterday, I got a letter from a prisoner also.
Oh,
and this guy has communicated with me. I just want to say this because not everyone is like that. And
no, they're
Jared
not.
Jared Remy could have found, and this is a 55-year-old black male.
Beautiful handwriting.
Beautiful handwriting. Is in prison for life for raping three women on three different occasions. He starts it, nice to see the NewsHour picked up your piece on the Marathon Norden Brothers. Good stuff. Together with Greater Boston covering the lead up to the race. And he talks about Meet the Press. He talks about the woman who walked. I mean, this is a guy who's engaged. I mean, there are people. I don't know if they would have been willing to help Jared Remy, but there are people who can put a sentence together who would have been able to communicate some thoughts or might have even given Jared Remy a little common sense, like, why don't you put it a different way?
Well, you know what else there are? You know, people make cynical jokes about people going to prison and finding the Lord. Some people do go to prison and find the Lord, because I'll never forget Tina Cherry, who's a mutual friend of ours who runs a Mother's March every year. About children who've been murdered in the city of Boston, and people getting together to support their families and so forth. She has in her office this book that lists all these prisoners that have sent her, like, their $3 canteen money and their $10, whatever they've earned in the canteen.
Really?
Because they were involved in a gang, or maybe they shot somebody, or they did terrible things in their youth that they're really sorry for now. So a lot of these prisoners, you know, they did terrible crimes. I mean, some of them are innocent. Not that many of them, from my experience, are innocent.
This guy doesn't proclaim his innocence.
But you know, they turn their lives around. And obviously, there's been no turning around yet here.
Well, it's only been a few months for Jared, anyway. Well, almost a year. For the other guy, we don't know who he is, Big E.
Let me just also say in closing, because Marjorie won't, because she's too humble, her column is terrific today.
Yes.
Thank you,
by the
Jim.
Way, the great reporter at the Herald, Laurel Sweet, one of my favorites, also got a letter of a different sort.
Yes, she did.
I would go by the Herald today and read this if you want
was
to
hers,
get insight.
The one to her wasn't as vicious?
No.
Well, Laurel
no.
Sweet, we should explain. Laurel Sweet, much to the, I'm sure, the prison officials' chagrin, managed to get through security and do an interview with Jared Remy, in which she basically let him talk, and she basically wrote about what he said in the newspaper, and they share a love of animals. And Jared actually wrote a nice letter to Laurel talking about how his dogs are doing.
In the same voice as this guy,
yes.
Biggie?
Same
spellings?
Yeah. Same spellings, that's correct, yeah.
And by the way, again, please read the letter. Please go to the Herald, go to the Herald website. This is, it gives you an insight into the mind of somebody who's accused of about as horrible an act as one possibly
we've scanned the handwriting, so you can actually see it, and you can see how the handwriting looks, and you can see the misspellings.
I would suggest this is an act of public citizenship on my part. Most of the people who added comments to Marjorie's story should seek help as soon as possible so they don't end up in the same place as Jared Remy. Okay, moving on. Thanks for doing this, Marjorie. This is generally why Emily's invited here every Friday. It would be this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not? This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Okay, that's it. That would be an introduction to Emily's List. And Emily, every week I'm supposed to ask you this question because you were angry one week when I didn't. Is this list thematic?
It is thematic.
Thank you. Okay,
but
I'll
we love
step
your
back.
Themes. Marjorie, I'm taking a lighter approach today. I think we need it.
I'm ready for a lighter approach.
It's been an awful week, and you know, I'm still hobbling around. Maybe I'm more sensitive to these things but I started putting a list together of things that I can't open. I mean, I'm sure you all have some, but I just can't open it. I cannot do it. It's like no matter what kind of a weapon I get out. So first up, and this really annoyed me this week, I got like two or three books in the mail here at GBH. Mm-hmm. I just put them in the recycle pile without opening them.
You have no idea even what the book was inside?
I mean, I was going to bring one down as a test case, but I couldn't carry it with all my other stuff here. And I thought, plus I couldn't open it, and I didn't even know what it was. You know, and so unless it has one of those little tabs that you can forget it.
You can't
it's
do it.
It's stapled on four sides, and it's in that thick. So you get out these. I've got all kinds of weapons. Forget it.
Before you go to number two on your list, this is totally coincidental. What were you and I discussing maybe two or three days ago that was one of the most brilliant 3 minutes of television ever?
Well, actually, I was going to say that Emily is morphing into her father, the late, great Andy Rooney, because...
One of the greatest pieces
Do you remember
ever.
The piece he did about trying to open the plastic...
The plastic container and something was in?
I have that on my list.
We'll stop.
Brilliant.
Did you not know about that?
I forgot about this, but the plastic
osmosis
has gotten a lot tougher.
Much tougher.
One of the things on my list is anything you buy from Best Buy or Staples, because flash drives, memory cards, anything, camera. It's this bulletproof plastic. It's much stronger than 20 years ago when my dad was talking about some plastic thing. You get at a pair of scissors from, you know, like Cutco scissors. It does not go through it.
Doesn't.
Yeah, I get to get the hammer, the sledge, the whole thing. By then, you've smashed whatever thing it is in there that you're trying to open, right?
It's true.
You
can't
do it.
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true.
And Cutco scissors cut through pennies. And
what are Cutco scissors?
They're really high-end.
I didn't know about those. I guess we all need them. And they're not enough?
not enough.
No, by the way, I can't believe you haven't had these experiences. It is impossible. Okay. And by the way, before you go ahead, then what you try to often do, and then I'll shut up, I promise, Emily,
right.
is you then take a tool that is dangerous.
Oh, right. I got
like,
that.
Oh, you fine, I'll shut up. No, go ahead.
All right, so anything packaged that says it's resealable, like cheese or salami slices, you can't open that thing and then put the zipper back together. No, so I always get out the Cutco scissors, and by then... And then I have to put it in another resealable bag because you
Correct.
Can't do it.
Brilliant. Correct. You're absolutely right. You Perfect. Have to make
$1 million
another big
this.
Bag.
All right. Any small package that says tear here, you have to do with your teeth. Am I right?
You have to.
You do. You can't do it any other way. You got to go, just because you can get out that little thing with your little fingers. And right?
Nothing absolutely. Like cutting your gum, too, when you do it that way. You ever
right,
done that?
So, have you ever tried any of these dips or marinades from Whole Foods? Like, they're marinades, and they come in this plastic
thing? Oh, sure, yes.
I mean, I've gotten out screwdrivers.
This is what I'm talking about. And you're at risk of putting one in your hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're cutting your finger off.
Yeah.
And get out, all kinds of inappropriate tools. All right. Let's face it, any prescription bottle. Once I've opened it, I leave it open. I just put it on the counter, and for small children and dogs, go at it. Because I don't put the top back on, do you? I don't.
No,
never.
It's really hard. It's really hard. You have to put like 20 pounds of weight on to get the screw top to screw off.
All right, I drink a lot of Perrier. Can't do it. I have to have one of those things that you buy at some kitchen.
The rubber thing.
Yeah, the rubber thing. It has to be right there on the counter so I can screw the top.
Because the whole thing turns around and it never cracks open.
Just cracking it open is impossible.
This is perfect.
All right, kettle chips. Mm. Not that I eat a lot of kettle chips.
Okay.
But those bags are like an armed fortress. You know? Am I right? You can get them in the cafeteria across the street. Forget it.
Terrible?
They're okay. They're crunchy, but they're not worth the effort.
Okay. Forget
to get into
that. Knock them right off.
Band-Aids? Can't do it.
You mean the paper or the plastic paper around
the band-aid?
And you rip the band-aid, of course, yeah.
Where do you guys stand on cans that have pull rings versus something that...
The ring always comes off before you get to open the thing.
You're right. I know. And you have to get out the can opener anyway. I've had very bad luck with ring things.
So I don't go for anything with a ring.
Except for the Paul Newman dog food ring thing. I've had good success with the Paul Newman dog food.
All right, so Jim.
You can win a Merrow for this, by the way. This is good.
Maybe this is just my sense of humor.
Okay.
But nothing makes me laugh harder than the thing you were just about to say. When somebody gets out a completely inappropriate tool, like a hatchet or a giant pair of, hedge
garden
clippers
shears or something,
to open something, some tiny little thing that is like, I always just fall over with laughter because it's like, that's what you resort to when you can't
open something. You have to.
Clippers or something.
Yeah, or a chainsaw. Or you have to call the
handyman. My father used to do it. Get out some giant knife. It's like he's going at something, and it's like, oh, my God. Yeah, you could slice off your hand.
Whole
you
hand
could slice
no
off
question.
Your hand because you get so frustrated. You just want to think. You know what kills me? Is if you,
now
do
I'm
you
laughing already.
Do you elect your toothbrushes?
Yes.
Okay, you buy the replacement.
Yeah,
the
forget it.
Toothbrushes and that plastic thing.
Can't do it.
You're right. You can't get
you
it out.
You've got to get out a sledgehammer. And then you smash the top off.
And what do you do when you're like 85, sitting there with your little 85-year-old spouse?
I know.
It's all over. You're just not going to be able to brush your teeth. You're not going to be able to open the cans. You're not going to be able to do
anything.
Most
passionate discussion we've ever had with Emily about anything.
That's
it. All right. I'm done.
I have to say, that was a top fiver. That was really
Everybody
spectacular.
Can relate to this.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
You have to have like a nuclear bomb to get open the toothpaste containers.
Okay, what are you
crazy.
Doing tonight on Beat the Press?
Oh, we're doing that guy, Clive
Bundy.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
I can't wait. I've got my pieces all written out, and it's like, all right, so this is the guy who got into the war with the federal government. He was letting his cattle graze in Nevada. They claim he owes, they say, $1 million in fees because it's public land, and while other people are paying fees. But then, the conservatives were all embracing him, including a lot of politicians. And then suddenly, Adam Nagourney, to his credit, goes out there, says, I wonder what this is all about with
From
this
the
guy
Times.
Anyway. The New York Times. And before you know it, Adam Nagourney has stepped in a cow pie. It's like, he's got this unbelievable story of this guy who, I have a few other things to say. And he goes on this whole racist rant about, Negroes, as he calls them. And that wasn't all. And then this morning, it goes viral, and CNN picked it up this morning, and he's defending himself. So there's it's just this. We've talked about this before, but there's no nut too crazy for the mainstream press to include in a newscast. It's like that guy, Fred Phelps from the Westboro Baptist Church.
Oh, yes.
Everybody gave him more attention than he deserved. He was the one who was picketing funerals. And the guy down in Georgia, I think it was, who was threatening to burn the Koran.
Yes.
It's like, we love these nuts.
We do love these nuts.
And we give them
shame
these,
on us sometimes, yeah. for even
it's one thing for Sean Hannity to give him a a platform, but now everybody is.
John Stewart has been on Sean Hannity's case all week. It's been terrific.
So we got that and more.
Can I make a suggestion? Yes. I never give you advice about your show. I do the segment on packaging tonight.
Oh, yeah, you did. All right, thanks, Jim.
I think it's got great television.
It's got legs.
Bring in the toothpaste.
Maybe I should do a piece. I should do a piece for TV.
Absolutely.
And then get out the hatchet at the
perfect.
End.
Emily, before you go, would you ever consider eating insects as an affordable and sustainable source of protein?
You,
like throw a few earthworms on the grill.
I've never been that hungry.
You would never do it.
No. Yeah.
Okay, well then tune in a couple of minutes. You'll learn something.
By the way, I don't
Emily,
mean to
thanks.
Keep saying toothpaste. I meant to say toothbrush.
Oh, okay.
Replacement.
We understand.
You know, my
Emily, great to see you. Good luck
problems.
Tonight.
Bye.
Emily, that was great. Thank you
that
very much for your wonderful list. Okay, up next we're going to ask you what we just asked Emily. If you consider eating insects instead of meat, just kick this fact around in your head before we open up the lines. It takes 2,000 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef, but only 1 gallon of water to produce 1 pound of insects. Could mealworm tacos and baked cricket chips be the way to go? That's next on WGBH 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
Can you mine the data to turn a television show into a hit?
We're talking. Tell me what we're talking about.
Oh, in the game, yo.
David Simon, Nate Silver, and House of Cards writer Bo Willimon talk with John Hockenberry about the art of creating stories by the numbers. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Cityside Subaru on Route 60 in Belmont, featuring the new Crosstrek Hybrid, Subaru's highest MPG all-wheel drive vehicle. More information available online at citysidesubaru.com. And Dayton Home of Wellesley, featuring a curated collection of furniture, lighting, decorative accessories, and design services. A design source for Boston and Metro West homeowners and designers. Information at dayton-home.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Mardrigan. Economists, what did I say? Economists? Well, they're the same as economists. Political leaders, environmentalists, members of the medical community, you know this, are fretting over the global food supply. Last year, in an effort to stem what could be a serious food shortage, the UN published a report advocating increased, you ready, insect consumption. That's right, increased insect consumption. People in other parts of the world apparently are frying scorpions, eating roasted caterpillars. And the question is, why shouldn't we? Some Harvard students have started this Kickstarter campaign to get their cricket chips, there really are cricket chips, on the market. Would you be one of their customers? If you eat shrimp and lobsters, why would you not eat mealworms? The number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Marjorie mentioned the water, how much water is needed to produce a pound of beef. There are a couple of arguments for this. One, if you're a vegetarian because you think that meat consumption is about lack of sustainability and morality. Well, obviously, bugs are a different story. They argue, Marjorie, that they have no pain receptors. That's a pretty big deal. You can raise a bug in a city, unlike a cow. 18% of the greenhouse gases comes from livestock, only 1% from insects. And I love the name of this company. It's trying to get started. It's called Six Foods, because six legs are better than four. 877-301-8970. What they actually have, those cookies Marjorie was describing, chocolate chirp cookies.
Yeah, chocolate chirp.
Ground cricket, flour, sugar, and chocolate chips. And by the way, I've told you this a million times. I don't know if they sell them anymore. I think there's some legal problems around this. Cardullo's, the sort of upper crust place in Harvard Square, used to sell chocolate-covered ants, chocolate-covered worms, those sort of things.
Crunchy,
and they all tasted quite fine. But you know what they can do here, which is the last thing I want to say, is bugs, if you feed them something, I don't know where I read this morning, either Boston Magazine or Boston.com, I'm not sure. If you feed them things, for example, they say like coriander and chamomile, unlike if you fed that to a cow, it would not change its taste. A bug takes on the taste of whatever you feed it. So essentially, you'd have a mealworm
right.
that has a chamomile and coriander kind of taste.
Drizzle a little hazelnut sauce over the top.
And how about what I said? I'm sure you're appalled by this. If you eat a shrimp or a lobster, which is a bottom feeder, why wouldn't you eat a scorpion?
Well, they did make a great point about the scorpions, that they taste pretty much like shrimp, but they don't taste quite as fishy. So I thought, I could see that. I mean, I'm not there yet, Jim.
Call Roger Berkowitz at Legal Seafood and ask when he's going to have scorpion cocktail on the menu.
But they do make a great environmental point, and that you know, we could be doing a lot more for planet Earth if we were not worried so much about cows and pigs, and if we were more worried about how we could, you know, spice up a little cricket or a little caterpillar to make it more appealing to our taste buds.
We both have smiles on our face, but I mean, this is real. It does make total sense, does it not?
Yeah,
you get your protein.
It's a psychological thing.
I understand
I'd have to get over the idea of eating a caterpillar, ground up and floured in cookies.
Yeah, but you see what they say? Some of these people who are starting this company put something like, I may get the number wrong, 35 or 40 cricket tacos in the refrigerator at wherever they work or something, and they were almost all gone because people had no idea. And I'm sure if you told them they were cricket tacos, I think the likelihood would be quite small they'd be eating them. And so you got to get over it. The less you know is the better in this case. And then when you find out, you say, what was that, by the way? And you find out it's scorpion, you're probably going to be okay. We only have a few minutes for this.
877-301-8970 is the number. Let's start with Pete and Wellesley. What do you think about this, Pete?
Hey, Pete.
Yeah, basically what you said earlier is one of the best arguments for it. I mean, squid, lobsters, shrimp, people think of them as a delicacy at this point. And, I mean, it's just smaller versions of the same thing. And basically there's no real solid argument against eating insects.
Okay, Pete, have you eaten any?
Yeah.
Really?
I have read a lot into it and done some. Mealworms are great. Some larger caterpillar, like the witchetty bug from Australia.
Hold on, Pete. How did you prepare the mealworms, please?
Roasting and frying is all right, definitely.
Wow.
Salted, peppered, yum, yum, yum.
I've always felt that grilled mealworm is better. How do you feel about grilled mealworm, Pete?
Wouldn't it fall through the cracks?
That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that. I have a special insect grill rack.
Hey, Pete,
thanks for
calling.
What?
Also, there are really, really interesting things, especially from Australia. There's one called the honeypot ant.
Yep.
Basically, it has a class within itself that basically just hangs from the ceiling, and all its buddies come along and just feed it nectar day in and day out until the abdomen swells up, and it's just literally a bug filled with honey.
Ooh.
Well, what's wrong with that?
I don't know. It's psychological, Pete. I'm
trying
to get there.
That's all it is. Psychological.
That's all it is. Thank you very much. I don't want to eat spiders, though. I don't want spiders. You know, even if they were all puffed up and full of honey, you got the little legs sticking out everywhere.
I'm not going to make the moral argument for a moment about eating an animal or whatever. And by the way, again, no pain receptors is a big deal. You ever been in a chicken coop?
They're disgusting.
Not only are they cruel for the most part. I know
there's
some exceptions. They're disgusting. They're dirty. You eat chicken? You love chicken.
Well, I get the free range.
Well, okay, fine.
From the
you ever seen a chicken wandering freely? I mean, they're not the most attractive.
No, but at least you feel like they had a good life before they bit the dust.
Fine, they had a good life. Well, bugs don't know. No pain receptors.
Yeah,
they're crunchy.
I'm not sure I believe that. Flies look pretty upset when, you know, children torture them. You ever see children torture flies?
Of course I have.
Terrible. And their little, I remember little backs and their legs are flying around wildly. Yeah. I think they're not enjoying themselves,
Jim.
I
love it when their legs are flying around wildly. I find that a really appealing
moment.
Yeah,
little house flies, you know, on their back. It's terrible. Let's go to...
Is that from The Fly or I think it was from some movie?
I don't know.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Chuck from Boston. What do you think about eating scorpions and mealworms?
I think it's a cool idea. But I just wonder about the nutritional quality of it because I think it comes down to the caloric content. And caterpillar and a worm, I mean, it's very interesting, but realistically, how many grams of protein and carbs and fiber will it have? You'd have to eat like maybe 50, 100? I think once you get into that realm, you're basically almost losing money or not being efficient in a sense because it can't be that easy collecting 50 worms.
Yeah, I'm trying
to
think about
a decent
how many
I don't know.
Caterpillars would make up a chicken breast.
I don't know.
I'm not sure.
That's a very good point.
I think you'd have to have at least
50?
I think you're putting the cart ahead of the caterpillar, as they say. I mean, I think we have to get people acclimated and accepting of the concept, and then you figure out how people are going to get enough protein. But I'll tell you one thing. We read one of the stories. 70%, is it as a scorpion we read, is protein. So the percentage of the thing you're eating, even if it's smaller, is the percentage of protein is much higher. So I guess you make it up on the other side or whatever it is. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Nathan from Weymouth, what do you think about eating bugs?
Hey, Nathan.
Hey, how you guys doing? Love your show.
Thank you.
Follow up for a long time, even when you guys won 96.9.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you guys are comic relief on a lot of levels.
Even when we don't try, that's the problem, Nathan. Go ahead. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I wouldn't mind trying a scorpion meal. It sounds pretty enticing. You talk about the 70%. Did you say about the protein?
70% of the it's either a scorpion or a caterpillar. That it's 70% of the content is protein, which is it's huge.
That is huge. Add some potatoes with that, and you got a meal.
I'm with you. Scorpion and a baked potato. It's my idea of a good night, Nathan. Thank you for the call. You know, when you think about it, though, you've seen a live shrimp, or you've seen a shrimp before it's peeled.
Yes.
I mean, they're not the most appealing. And by the way, a scorpion. You know, a scorpion looks like a little tiny lobster.
Yeah.
You've seen a scorpion. It's got the claws. Like we're trained to be scared of them. Needless to say, but lobsters are not a thing you want to hang out with either when they're alive. And so you cook them.
I've seen people eat those soft shell crab.
You know what the other thing about lobsters is? This is another argument for scorpions against lobsters. I have heard from a reliable source, and I admit this is not from some scientific journal. This is horrible to even say, that lobsters are monogamous, which if that's true, it makes you never want to eat a lobster.
Oh.
Yes, I knew I shouldn't have said that to you. So you don't like lobster much anyway.
No, I don't.
But for those who do, I don't know. If that's not true, you can tweet us or call us right away correct me.
Maybe if they're monogamous, they both go into the trap together.
What if they don't? It's problematic, wouldn't you say? And I think scorpions are polygamous. So they that's what I've read. I'm not...
I didn't know that Alex Beam was here. Solomon in the Bible had
700
wives.
Well, he had 1,000. Amanda, our coworker,
busy
came up
guy.
With 700. Okay, take it away. A couple of more quick
okay,
ones.
Okay, Zach on the road. What do you think about eating bugs, Zach?
Hey.
Bugs can be delicious. It depends on the preparation, I think.
Yeah, what have you
do
eaten?
Do you know that or not?
I do, actually. When I was a kid, I used to be really into, I kind of saw myself as a budding naturalist, and I was into scouting and everything. So I've eaten pretty much any edible insect native to New England.
Really?
Like, give us a couple of examples, if you can, please, and how you prepared them.
Oh, well, it was probably a terrible idea for my father to give me the book as a kid, but I would go out in the backyard and I'd collect, you know, everything from those little pill bugs that look like armadillo beetles, little guys, to earthworms, mealworms, different kinds of spiders, some kinds of bees, and even wasps and hornets. I mean, indigenous peoples all over the world have been preparing insects as part of their staple.
No, that's true.
Now, wait a minute. With the wasps and the hornets, what about the stinger?
You actually grind them up with the stinger in them. It's a little bit tangy, and they fry. You fry the hornets. It's almost, they do it in a prep, almost like a grain, believe it or not. So
you grind them up so you don't see the wings flapping.
Yeah, that's probably it, you know.
This is really not a conversation you should have with Marjorie.
I just can't.
Zach, you're telling the truth about all this, right? You've had all this experience, and it's all good.
Absolutely. It's all good.
He sold me. Zach, thank you for the call.
Okay,
we can squeeze one more in.
Why don't you go try some this weekend?
Well,
Let me know how
I tell you what I'm embarrassed by? And I'm going to call one of these people after the show. I have no idea where you even get these kinds of things, because my assumption was a lot of the reason that Cardullo's, I think, stopped selling them is because there was some law that prohibited it. But maybe if they're locally raised, I don't know. Where do someone raise scorpions in Massachusetts?
I don't know.
Check it out, will you? And get back to me.
Suzanne,
one more quick
Suzanne
one.
Suzanne on the road. What do you think, Suzanne, about eating bugs?
Oh, hello. Well, I don't know. I don't know. The caterpillar thing might be okay, but I was thinking when you were comparing a scorpion to shrimp, like when you eat, I wonder if they're boiled because I wouldn't want to like eat the outside of the
me neither
shrimp.
Oh yeah.
And so I'm wondering if somebody would please pick out the the meat out of the scorpion, then I'll just close my eyes. I think I'd be okay.
Well, maybe it's like the little lobster legs where you have to get one of those little teeny tiny forks and pick the meat out or something like that.
That would be kind of a fun thing to do, to sit there and pick out the meat. But I don't know. I mean, I'm open to it because I think it's a very interesting subject.
Yeah,
it's good for the earth, and it apparently is. It's comparably speaking quite healthy. Vegetarians, at least if most of their objections are allayed, they can go back to eating some sort of. I'm serious. It's really is something that deserves investigation. Suzanne, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
I think I'll stick with the eggs and the cheese.
No, if I brought them in, I'm going to try to, one of my missions over the weekend, I'm going to try to find something that
Jim.
Falls into this category and bring it in.
Bring it in and we'll watch you eat it.
No, I'm serious. You're going to try it.
Oh, no, I'm not.
Oh, yes, you are.
Oh, no, I'm not. Okay, up next is our Friday news quiz. We have two voiceover artists taking on the week's headlines. What promises to be a sonorous conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Remember last winter? Well, here's one good thing that happened. More than 10,000 sustainers earned their very own WGBH production credit. Now, it's your turn. Sustainers break their gifts down into monthly installments that automatically renew. And if you sign on as a sustainer before the first day of summer, you might see or hear your name listed alongside some of the best producers in the country. Get your name on the list at wgbh.org/sustainer.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, committed to providing patients with quality cancer care, innovative services, and personalized treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer. And Moo.com, where you can print business cards with the option of a different design on every card in a pack. You can say hello with Moo.com. That's Moo.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she, of course, is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 for our Friday news quiz, the Golden Voices edition, is Don Gunnan. He's a voiceover and narration artist who also works down the hall from us at WGBH. Boy, is this weird. Hi, Don. How are you?
It's very strange, and I am humbled and honored to be in your presence.
Well, we feel the same way about you, by the way. Not to mention that we're joined by Boston-based actor and voiceover artist Sally Nutt, who loves to tell a good story. You can see her on stage in June in Fort Point Theater Channel's next show, Waiting for Gilgamesh. Sally, it's great to meet you. Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure.
It's very exciting to have you both in here. And I must admit, because I see him every day,
yeah,
Don,
I'm
listening to you this morning doing the Planters Nuts, the commercial for them.
Right.
Not all smokers die from smoking.
Yes.
You've done a million ads.
I thought it was funny that the first thing on my demo is the word nuts. And I'm working with Sally Nutt. So.
She's never heard a nut joke before. I want you to know this. She's ever. Can we hear
you
a little bit?
You don't think I've heard any goon jokes?
Speaking of goon, can we hear a little bit of what Gunnan has to say? Here's a little sound, and you may recognize some of this.
Uh-oh.
This is Don Gunnan. Listen up.
Nuts. One simple word that can mean so much. But precede it with the word planters, and the meaning is clear. My kids will tell you I'm a little behind the curve when it comes to new technology. I don't have a desk job, so I'm not into email, and I use my cell phone mostly for talking. You can feel the emotion of movies the way filmmakers intend for you to experience it, but only if you have accurate and dramatic sound. Here in Concord, Massachusetts, behind a wall and razor wire, is MCI Concord, a medium security prison. Vote no on question 2. It's out of control.
That's the one.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. You hear that question, too, don't
you? Can I tell you something? Before we even hear Sally and talk to her for a bit, this is one of my dreams, by the way. I know you're looking at me weirdly already, Sally. When we do talk radio for years, what both Marjorie's friends and mine say, I could do that. All you do is you just go in and talk, right? You do a talk, and then you have a radio show. Tell me people don't say to you, I could be a voiceover artist, too, right? An actress, whatever.
They do.
And they're wrong, are they not?
But no, you truly have a gift.
Who's that? I do?
You and Margie.
Can you get me a couple of gigs or something?
I can't talk. What do you mean?
Were you an actress first, or were you a voiceover person?
An actress, yes, from way back, like third grade.
And did people approach you about doing voiceover stuff, or did you say, hey, this is an additional thing I can do to further my career, make a few bucks, that sort of thing?
Yeah, the latter. Started different jobs I had, and opportunities came up, and I pitched in and would do a voiceover, and it just grew from that.
The rest of the session. Why don't we hear a little bit of Sally Nutt's voiceover work, and then we'll start the quiz. Here it is.
Honey.
Yeah.
Now that the holidays are over, it's time to start thinking about our anniversary.
Oh, that's right. Now, when was that again?
Oh, honey.
Just kidding. Any gift ideas in mind?
Oh, maybe a gift that says, I love you, and I'd
if
marry you
all
over
again. If you wish to report a lost or stolen card, please press 2. For all other inquiries, or to speak to a customer service representative, please press 5. To repeat this menu, press 6.
For perforated or abscessed appendicitis of mild to moderate severity, the guidelines recommend ticarcillin clavulinate, sulfoxetin, ertapenem, moxifloxacin, or tigecycline.
Wow. I want you to repeat all those drugs right now without any notes. Can you do that?
Those are always fun, you know, aren't they, the medical stuff. Yeah.
And also, doesn't everybody wonder who is that person who says press 1 for so-and-so, and it's
exactly.
You.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize that voiceover artists are hired to do that.
Yeah, and Sally's acted in all over the place, in Maine and all over Boston Lyric Theater. I mean, you've got an unbelievable resume as well.
Thank you.
You're
That's
welcome.
Very sweet.
We'll talk
you're
about
fine.
The thing you're doing in June in a couple of minutes, but let's get to the quiz. Can we do that?
Okay.
Uh-oh. Why don't you start with our coworker? So if he does poorly, he'll be angry at you instead of me, and I'll work
okay.
with Sally
you ready?
Here.
Wait a minute. News quiz? I thought this was trivia. I'm sorry.
Well, sort of. A little bit of both. Okay. Here we go, Don.
Okay.
In what non-traditional way did a 16-year-old kid get to Hawaii? Here is David Letterman.
Boy. This happens every 4 or 5 years. A kid, 16-year-old kid, gets on an airplane in San Jose, California. But he didn't really get on. He just climbs up into the the plane takes off, closes up the the kid's in there. Ah. Kid, they're going to Hawaii. Of course, JetBlue. That's business class. If you ever fly.
Whoa.
Okay. Do you know how this
kid
got to Hawaii?
Didn't have that little TV screen in the car, the wheel well thing.
The wheel well. That is absolutely correct.
I'm surprised he survived it.
Yeah.
Man.
Can you believe the story? They say it is as low as minus 70 degrees.
Yeah.
The air is 20% of the typical oxygen.
Yeah.
And they say the only way you survive, your brain survives, because it essentially freezes.
Someone once said, I read this as a part of the story, that you're only dead if you're warm and dead.
Is that so?
That was some medical doctor who either was making a joke. But the point was that at that temperature, this is like suspended animation kind of thing.
That means no one's ever died at Antarctica. That's fabulous news. It's good science there, Don. Okay, Sally, you ready to try to tie this baby up?
Yes, sir.
Who is this speaking here? Listen, make sure you listen to the whole thing before you answer. And what did he do earlier this particular week?
Coming as an America to be able to turn that left turn and to get the crowd going. I made sure I looked out. But, you know, this is beyond running. This is for the people. An American winning it and giving the USSA cheer just beyond words. I am blessed for God to give me the opportunity to do it and try to touch people's life. And you know what? We did it.
The story of the week, one of the stories of the week. Who is that, Sally Nutt?
He is the amazing Meb, and you're going to make me try to say that last
name. Well, you need your points anyway.
Teflesiki?
That is
very
close.
Good.
Wow.
That is very impressive.
The mayor wouldn't even try his last name an hour ago. Do you know? That is right.
It's very, very tough.
How inspiring. By the way, was that great? I mean, was that, talk about perfect ending to a terrific day. That was
great.
Well,
you know, I was goosebumps now
Me
just
too.
Thinking about it.
Me
you
too.
Know what's great about him is that he had the forethought to do things like put the, on his bib, in magic marker, the names of the four people that were killed either at the marathon or Shanghai, of course, the MIT police officer, Martin Richards' name, and Lindsay Liu and Crystal Campbell. He put them on his bib.
It wasn't forethought, though. It was respect. He didn't think he was going to win the race.
No, but
he did it because he cared about the people and Boston Marathon.
But I mean, how
beautiful.
Many people would even think of that before the race? I'm going to put these names on here. And then he talked about how, you know, great it was to be an American and all these kinds
of
things. It was wonderful. He red, white, and blue outfit, too.
Okay, Don Goonan, 1 point. Sally Nutt, 1 point. Marjorie.
Okay, here we go. Here we go. Here is Seth Meyers weighing in on some current news.
Has announced that she is pregnant with her first child. Yeah, great news. The baby's expected to crawl after 9 months and run in 2055.
Okay. You know who's got the bun in the oven there, Don?
Yeah. Chelsea Clinton.
That is correct. Absolutely. Okay.
Okay, you ready? This is your opportunity, Sally Nutt. Sally, who is David Letterman talking about in this clip? Oh, sorry. We're skipping that one. Thank you very much. Here is, but that would have been a great question. You would have liked that a lot. Yeah, here you go. I'll tell you afterwards. Okay, what holiday is Stephen Colbert talking about in this clip?
Forget planting trees or picking up litter. We should all celebrate like Fox News host Eric Bolling.
It's an annual event in my household. We open all the windows, we turn up the heat or the air conditioner, whichever is opposite of what the temperature is outside. And I spark up the 90,000 BTU barbecue just for and cook some steaks.
Way to stick it to the greenies, Eric. Man, I would hate to be the dumbass who has to pay this guy's utility bills.
Okay, Sally Nutt, what was Colbert talking about? What holiday?
Earth Day.
That is correct. That is exactly right. Before we go to the next round, what's waiting for Gilgamesh, and what do you play? What do you do?
I am one of six actors that just got cast, as a matter of fact. It's written by an Iraqi playwright that will be at the Arsenal Center for the Arts. And it's a co-production with the Joyner Center and Fort Point Theater Channel and a couple other organizations. It should be very interesting.
Want to give us one sentence on the story?
It's about different people's reactions. I actually haven't seen the final script
yet. Oh, okay.
But it's about different people's reactions after the war.
Oh, so. Sounds great.
Okay, who are living there.
So, Don, tell us how you got into doing voices for commercials.
And who I should call is really the question.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, the old cliche, the old Ted Baxter, it all started back in the 50,000-watt station. Yeah, it was radio first and production and engineering after that, and then that sort of led to doing voiceover. I mean, you're always doing local commercials at stations, and then a few people say, geez, you know, will you do this for this and for money? So, of course. Yeah. So it was pretty much started that way, and I love it. It's just a wonderful.
And what happens when a friend of yours, let's say Marjorie Egan,
yeah,
finds out you are the voice, we're not going to say of what in particular, of something she finds very distasteful. For example, you are the voice of a particular ballad. That's the perfect answer to the question.
Yeah, that's right. Well,
you can finish it. What happens if you're offended by what,
yeah,
by what I do?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of more your problem.
That's
than
a good point.
Than mine.
That's a good
point. No, it's funny you said it because there have been instances where you sort of always go through that, I think, Sally, as well. Would you do this? Well, let me see it. Do I agree with it? Am I pro it? You know, in the beginning, it was much more the heart was there. Over years, the wallet dictates what
gets done.
We have
an honest man in this studio, I'll tell
you. But you have to pay the bills.
You have to have a great voice, though, which obviously you do, and so do you, Sal. You've got a beautiful voice.
Thank you.
I mean, you have to have, you know, obviously, a beautiful-sounding voice to do this kind of work, correct?
Well, and there's
you
also
can't improve it, can you?
No, but you know, it's about your breath and staying fit, and there are other things besides just what you're.
She sounds totally different from how we sound. I mean, she does,
doesn't
she? I had
to go to a speech coach twice.
You did?
Yes, and it hasn't really helped
very
much.
Well, but you think of that. Think of like an Arnold Stang, the old chunky guy.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Who would have thought?
You're right. You have to stand out. You have to be memorable.
There's acting ability and all that. And nowadays, it's more the guy next door is what people are looking for. They're not looking for the old Ted Baxter.
Okay, next question,
Marjorie.
Guess
that lets you out, Jim. They're not going to be calling you.
Ted Baxter.
Okay.
Next.
Am I on Letterman?
You are, yep.
Okay. Who's David Letterman talking about in this clip? Who's the political personality of whom he speaks?
Anybody here from your mayor running for re-election, ladies and gentlemen. How about that guy? You've got a catchy campaign slogan. Forget my first term. I was on crack.
I'm blanking out. I can't think of his name.
You can tell us where he's from.
That's not Christie from New Jersey, although I suppose
nope.
It could be. No, it's the guy from Canada. He's the crack guy.
It's the guy
he's the crack guy.
It's the guy.
Do we give him the points or do we
Canada.
Not? What about judges? Yes, you got the points.
I thought you said what state. That's why.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No,
I'm
you
sorry.
Probably didn't. I probably just misheard you.
Okay.
You got the points. Now, here's your opportunity to tie it up, selling up, before we go to the bonus round. Here's Jimmy Fallon delivering some news on a new coffee trend.
This week, Purina is opening a cafe here in New York City.
Oh, it gets weirder. Where customers will get to play with while they drink their coffee. It's going to be annoying and weird when the baristas are like, oh, I have a latte for a...
What kind of cafe is Purina opening, Sally Nutt?
Oh, my goodness gracious. I don't know.
I think if you just, like, what's in your heart, I think will be the correct answer.
Cotton candy.
Well, that would be incorrect. Well,
you're not allowed to get clues. Dog food.
Well, that's close, but that would be wrong. Do you want to steal this, Don?
I thought I stole it with dog food. Evidently not.
Well, it's a cat cafe.
Oh.
Okay, here's the deal. The score is 3-2 going into the bonus round. Since you're both voiceover artists, as we know, and in addition, you were an actress, Sally Nutt, as we know, we're going to ask you about the voice that launched at least 1,000 movies. That, of course, is Don LaFontaine. Here he is.
In a world in the year 2017,
in a time of tradition,
in a city where anything can happen,
in a war that isn't his,
every day in New York City,
on the Miami Police Force,
in the deep south, from the sewers of Gotham.
That's pretty unbelievable.
That was great.
Rest his soul.
That was great.
God on earth.
How long ago did he die?
Well, I don't want to. 3-4 years ago, more
2008,
than that.
Our crack production staff is telling us, Chelsea.
Hal Douglas recently died. Hal Douglas was the other movie trailer guy.
Wow, he's got That was a great voice. Okay. I'm going to start with
Sally Nutt.
People get these wrong all the time, so don't feel bad if you do. Don LaFontaine had three nicknames: the King of the Movies, the Voice of God, and the third nickname was, I'm going to give you three choices: Tinsel Tongue, Velvet Vox, or Thunder Throat.
I love Velvet Vox.
That's a good one.
I don't actually know.
Was that your guess?
Is that your guess?
That'll be my guess.
Sorry, that's not right.
I'm sorry.
Do you know, Don?
Oh, and I was hoping you'd just say no and give me a different question.
Is it Tinsel Tongue or Thunder Throat?
Probably Tinsel Tongue because it's all Hollywood stuff.
That would be wrong.
Thunder Throat made more sense, but
I figured it was too obvious.
Okay.
Well, in any case, I was wrong. Now, Don Goonan, here's your question to expand your lead. What pro bono work did Don LaFontaine do? A, record the outgoing messages on people's answering machines. B, his yearly food drive, Vox and Bagels. Or C, record the emergency evacuation instructions for the Fresno, California school system. Which of those three, A, B, or C, please?
I will go with A.
You would be right.
Oh, yeah!
Now, Sally, the good news for you is the final question, coincidentally, is worth 2 points, which is exactly how far behind you are. If you get this right, you leave in a glorious tie. Marjorie?
Okay, here we go, Sally. In 2005, LaFontaine was on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Sorry.
That's not right. Question three is at the bottom of the page.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's my mistake.
Okay. Can you detect a regional accent in LaFontaine's voice? Okay. You want to hear that?
Sure.
It is.
In a world, in the year 2017,
in a time of tradition,
in a city where anything can happen,
in a war that isn't his.
Okay. Here's the question. Where's he from? Duluth, Minnesota, Oswego, New York, or Grand Junction, Colorado?
Take your time. This is a big one. This is for all the marbles, Sally Nutt.
And I don't have a lifeline, right?
Do not have a lifeline. She's tapping her fingers on the counter here, nervously, I should say.
Thoughtfully.
Okay, Duluth, Minnesota, Oswego, New York, or Grand Junction, Colorado?
I'll go with Grand Junction.
I wouldn't if I were you. As a friend, and we've become friends very quickly, I really wouldn't. So it's either Duluth or Oswego is what Marjorie meant to ask.
That's right. Oswego.
Okay, fine. You come in second. And
you know,
Don Goonan comes
Duluth
in first. Have you either been watching Fargo, the television version of Fargo on FX with the Minnesota accents? Oh, my God. Over the top.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you. Don, do you have a website?
I do.
What is it?
It's dongoonan.com, but you can also get there via voiceboston.com.
Perfect. And how about you, Sally Nutt?
Anyactor.com/Sally Nutt.
Terrific. Nutt with two T's, we should say. Sally,
two T's.
It was a pleasure to meet
you. I hope you had fun.
This was a blast.
I appreciate it.
Don, great to see you.
Thank
came
you.
Came in, and I didn't realize, you guys both, the voices are gorgeous. And the pictures
you so
on your
much.
Website are pretty nice, too, Sally. I checked those out. You look smashing in every single one of them. Okay, well, we want to thank you both for coming
thank you
in.
Very much.
much.
Don Goonan is a voiceover and narration artist. You can learn more about him, as we just said, at Don Goonan, that's GOONAN.com. Sally Nutt, with two T's, is a Boston-based actor and voiceover artist. You can see her on stage in June in Four Point Channel's next show at the theater there, Waiting for Gilgamesh. Thank you very much. To learn more about it, go to fourpointtheaterchannel.org. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in on Monday for All Revved Up with the Reverend Irene Monroe and the Reverend Emmett Price. And veterinarian Nick Trout will also be here to talk about his new book. We're also going to talk some politics as well. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and Alan Mattis. Thank you very much for listening to another edition. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Brownlee.
And please tune in again on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Bye.